Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Simon Rich is an American humorist who's from New York City and has accomplished quite a lot in his 34 years on this planet. Rich has written for Saturday Night Live, Pixar, and The Simpsons, and he was named showrunner when FXX adapted one of his short story collections for their now-finished series, Man Seeking Woman. Some of his other story volumes include Spoiled Brats and Ant Farm, and he is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. Rich's latest short story book is called Hits and Misses, an incredibly smart and funny meditation on measures of success and expectations based on internal and external pressure, and it's available now via Little Brown and Company. Simon and I connected a little while ago to talk about things like Los Angeles and Toronto, Adolf Hitler, the Kinks and the magnetic fields, his penchant for short-form writing and sketches, show business generally, this new book, Hits and Misses, his future plans, and much more. With the support of listeners like you who subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly pledges at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, this is the 434th episode of Creative Control, featuring the brilliantly funny Simon Rich, with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
Now that you've made me want to die, you tell me that you're unboyfriendable, and I could make you pay and pay, but I could never make you stay. Not for all the tea in China, not if I could sing like a bird, not for all North Carolina, not for all my little words, not if I could write for
me. Hi Simon, how's it going?
Good, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Where in the world are you today?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, California. How are things going there?
Things are going well, thank you. Very sunny day as usual. I spent a lot of time in Toronto, I miss it. I haven't been back in a little while.
That's right. You, I believe, your series "Man Seeking Woman" is it still in Toronto or is it done? I don't know what's going on with your show. That's a bad way to start. I apologize.
It's all good. The show sadly is no more, but we did 3 seasons and all of them were filmed in and around Toronto.
That's right, with Canada's own Jay Baruchel.
That's right.
Yeah, and this was based on a collection of short stories, correct?
Yes. The show was called Man Seeking Woman, it was based on a book I wrote, it was a lot of fun and great Canadian crew, and we're very fortunate to get 80% of the kids in the hall to appear in it, which was really exciting for me as a huge lifelong fan. And yeah, it was a great experience.
Now, is it unusual for a TV series to be adapted from a collection of short stories? It seems to me that it is. Is that, what do you make of that, the fact that that happened?
Yeah, it is pretty unusual. And from the very beginning, you know, I kind of made a hard decision, which was to not do that book to not adapt it as a sketch show. Because that's sort of the temptation when you have a bunch of stories that are maybe thematically linked, but in all different genres, you know, and about all different characters. The logical thing is, well, I'll just do a sketch show and just change it up every 5 minutes. But I was really determined, especially with Jay as the lead, to try to create something that was cohesive and narratively propulsive and character driven. And so we did it as a proper romantic comedy. We kept the characters consistent, and we just changed up the sort of the genre. It was a weird show, Man Seeking Woman. You know, it was filled with you know, monsters and time travel and space aliens and robots. But they were all kind of used. All those supernatural hooks were used as metaphors to kind of show what was going on to our protagonist emotionally.
Right. So did you do a thing where almost all of the short stories became? I mean, some of them I don't think could work. But you tell me. Did you do a thing where almost every one of the short stories became an episode of the show?
No. Because yeah, like, you know, not everything is readily adaptable for the screen. A lot of what I do, especially with fiction, is I'll sometimes parody specific styles, you know, and so a lot of the success of some of the stories is dependent on like the prose itself, you know, when you're parodying, you know, Lewis Carroll, it's like the degree to which you can imitate the prose is like that's the most important aspect of it. So when you have actors doing it, all of a sudden it kind of loses something.
So only
about, I would say, a quarter of the stories ended up on the screen, and we burned through them pretty quickly. By the end of the first season, we had completely run out of material from the book.
So what you just had to start writing anew?
Yeah, and that's the fun part, you know, is working, you know, working with a writing staff and working with talented people and just kind of taking that same strategy and coming up with new ways to employ it.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your penchant for writing short stories and short story collections, but I do want to, before I do that, I want to ask you something that I don't think I've ever said to a guest on this show, which is that you seem to have a thing for Hitler.
Yeah, it's true.
Hitler has become this. I don't want to say you're normalizing Hitler, but you seem to have this notion that he might be a normal 124-year-old man at some point. Is that
right?
Fair?
Right.
Is that fair?
Well, I definitely have written about Hitler in most of my books, if not all. You know, obviously a very interesting character.
Let's just follow up on that. What is interesting to you about Adolf Hitler?
Well, I mean, he's, you know, arguably the most evil person in human history.
That's,
you know,
true.
I've always been interested in extremes of all kinds, you know, growing up as a fan of, you know, Stephen King and, you know, Ray Bradbury, I always liked fictional characters that were extreme in some way.
Right.
And then occasionally history itself generates a character that's, you know, as extreme, if not more extreme than anything you find in fiction. And when one of those characters appears in real life, it's hard not to be fascinated by them.
Absolutely. But when I read your depictions of Hitler, I just picture him walking down a street in Brooklyn. And that's
right. Well, that's one story. Yeah. The pilot of Man Seeking Woman is adapted from one of my stories, where a guy finds out that his ex-girlfriend is dating this much older, wealthier guy, and he is really upset especially when he finds out that he is in fact Adolf Hitler, who in the story faked his death after World War II and escaped to Buenos Aires and is now a 127-year-old man dating his ex-girlfriend. And he's especially upset because all of his friends seem to think that this Hitler guy is actually pretty cool when you get to know him and has funny stories. And he's the only one who seems upset by it. And it's just sort of a metaphor for how sometimes when you love somebody and they've moved on, you you feel very isolated and lonely in your hatred of that new person, you know, because and your friends don't always take your side. So that's very much what that show Man Seeking Woman was all about, was kind of coming up with ways to talk about dating and love and relationships in a way that, while not like realistic and accurate, was at least emotionally honest. You know, it was always our goal was always to write about love, not the way that it happened, but the way that it felt.
Yeah, no, that comes across in your writing. I often speak with musicians and writers, and when I'm talking to them about the work that they've put out into the world, you know, the things they've expressed, I try to get to whether or not any of those stories or song ideas are drawn from personal experience. So I must ask, just to follow up on what we were discussing, if you encountered Hitler or a Hitler-like figure who has kind of disrupted your love life or your life generally?
Oh, I mean, everything I've ever written is autobiographical, for sure. I don't know how an author could write something authentic that wasn't based on their own experiences. I think that my own personal life and my own, you know, autobiography, it's pretty boring. Nothing unusual really has happened to me. But every person on Earth has felt, you know, the same kind of palette of human emotions, right? We've all felt, I think, things like bitterness and jealousy and longing and sadness and loneliness and
sure.
And frustration and joy and excitement and you know, you start from a place of kind of self-reflection, and then you try to come up with a story that will dramatize how you felt, you know, and or how you've felt in your life, and you just hope that other people will say, hey, yeah, I've been there.
Now,
that's the whole goal.
Right. And so you've drawn from real life experiences, but then you often create, I should say, these surreal sort of worlds, you know, like it seems like relatable, but, you know, I loaned your latest book that, you know, one of the reasons we're talking today is because you have this great new collection, Hits and Misses. By the way, I loved it. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. And I loaned it to my wife. We just got back from a vacation and I loaned it to her. And so we're reading and she just would giggle incessantly. She just, and that doesn't happen very often. It's to make someone, you know, to write something where someone is just laughing out loud. I think that's you've done a remarkable thing.
And I really appreciate it. And tell her thank you for me too.
I will for sure. But this is the thing, like, I mentioned the Hitler thing, and I don't want to dwell on Hitler because, you know, I think we've been talking about Hitler for some time.
We can dwell on Hitler.
Well, not just you and me. I mean, as a society, we talk about Hitler a lot. But you've done a thing in this book with Hitler where you've taken it's the story is called Adolf Hitler, the GQ Profile, which I just thought was a really brilliant way of talking about Hitler and taking these kind of magazine templates, you know, these character profiles, which are rather ridiculous, and it's just a magical thing. What exactly is it? As simple as that? You just thought, like, what if I applied these kind of, you know, character portrayals and just made it about Hitler? I mean, it is
as simple as that. So, with that piece, that's a pretty straight ahead satire for sure. But yeah, as you said, it's like, these celebrity profiles, they're so formulaic and they're so vacuous. You can't help but be sucked in by them.
Yeah.
There's something very seductive about the way that they, you know, purportedly demystify celebrity. And this book, Hits and Misses, is very much a book about, you know, about success and failure and, to a certain extent, you know, celebrity. So I wanted to kind of write a piece that was that got at kind of the emptiness of celebrity. And so I thought, what better, you know, what's emptier than a celebrity profile? and to kind of try to expose that template, as you said. I thought, you know, gosh, these profiles are so ridiculous. Even if it were Hitler, they would still try to imbue him with some kind of value and worth.
Yeah.
And so it kind of wrote itself.
Yeah. No, it's a strange, like, you say you're in Los Angeles today. Why are you in Los Angeles? Is that where you've been living lately?
Yeah, I moved out here fully a couple of years ago, and I think that really affected my writing. That most of my story collections, at least, you know, on a superficial level, they were all very New York based. I mean, the stories were often set in New York. And hits and misses. I mean, like all my books, it kind of jumps all over the place. And, you know, some are set in ancient and, you know, in ancient Jerusalem, and some are set in, you know, revolutionary era America. And, you know, it's all over the place. But a lot of the stories are set in LA. And I think that's just, you know, I'm an autobiographical writer, as I said, and I can't help but be influenced by where I'm living.
Yeah. And I don't mean to go through your resume too much here, but you are imbued within show business by this point. You've written for Saturday Night Live and you've with Pixar, The Simpsons, and you've had your own series. Are you a little jaded? And you're young. You're still a young guy, right? You started young.
Right. I started young, and I've been now doing it for over 10 years, the sort of show business thing. And
are you at this point a little like jaded about it, or are you still like, what the hell is wrong with everyone? Like, how are you dealing with it?
Yeah, I love it, obviously. You know, I feel really fortunate to get to write stories for a living, and, you know, both in book form and for the screen. It's one of my favorite, you know, it's my favorite thing to do in the world. And so I feel mostly gratitude. And what's interesting is I always wanted to write a book about show business and to write a book about subjects like fame and success and celebrity. But I always was a little bit anxious to do it because I was worried it wouldn't be relatable to people outside of the industry. And then with the advent of social media, it kind of gradually occurred to me in the last few years that everyone kind of knows in 2018, to a certain extent, what it means to deal with issues of celebrity. You know, you have a situation where teenagers are working hard to figure out their social media brand, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and a typical child poses for more photographs than a major movie star would have, you know, 50 years ago. And we're living in this time where there's really no escape from public scrutiny. You don't have to be living in Hollywood and pursuing, you know, movie star dreams in order to know what it's like to have strangers making fun of you, for example, because of the way you look or because of something you said. So there's a big fan of this band, The Kinks, and Ray Davies has this great line where he says, everybody's in showbiz, it doesn't matter who you are. And I think that that's, you know, more true now than ever.
I like that you said this band, The Kinks, like they were some new underground rock band that we may not have heard of.
Well, I don't know how, you know, I don't know how young your listeners are.
Hey, The Kinks might be coming back, I heard. The Kinks might be coming back.
I saw that. No, it's exciting. I mean, I think, you know, I think to me, Ray Davies is the great English songwriter.
Yeah, no, he's unbelievable. You are, I don't mean to jump all over the place, but you are a pretty massive music fan. I understand that, like, I will tell you that my wife and I, who I alluded to earlier, our first dance wedding song was a Magnetic Fields song.
Oh, which one?
It's Only Time.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
beautiful.
So I'm a big, that's from the record I. I know you're particularly fond of 69 Love Songs, right?
I love 69 Love Songs. I love I, too. I Don't Believe You is what maybe my favorite song on that album.
Yes. It's
Stephen Merritt's great. A lot in common with Ray Davies. I got to meet Merritt one time.
Yeah.
And I asked him what he thought of Ray Davies, just because I'm always curious when you meet one of your heroes, you know, it's fun to ask him about your other heroes to see if there's any kind of like triangulation. And he didn't seem to really go for the Kinks that much, which was disappointing to me, but you know, it is what it is.
I've interviewed Stephen a few times and I've written some longer biographical piece about him and his life. And I think he is You know, he is one of our most endearing contrarians, generally.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just a beautiful, beautiful songwriter.
Absolutely, yeah.
And a huge, huge inspiration on me because, you know, even though I'm not a professional musician, with 69 Love Songs, his goal was to come at a very universal, accessible topic, you know, love. And to come at it from as many different angles as he possibly could, you know, to write about all the vicissitudes of love, you know, and what it's like when it's going well, what it's like when it's going badly, what it's like when you have it or want it or used to have it and don't have it anymore. And also he was playing with genre, you know, and he was using genre as a way to come at the subject from different angles. And so, you know, I would listen to that triple album on repeat as I was writing Man Seeking Woman, and it had a huge, huge impact on me.
Well, he's also extremely funny.
Yeah, and he's really funny. He's really funny. He's not afraid to write from unlikable perspectives, you know. And I'm a big fan of Belle and Sebastian as well, of course, and you know, one of the cool things about Belle and Sebastian is that even though their songs are often first person songs, the protagonist will shift.
Yeah.
And you know, and sometimes it'll be a protagonist who's very hateful or
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Or ignorant or naive or flawed in some way. And then, of course, Ray Davies would do that too. And it can be very liberating as a writer to write from these kind of unusual points of view. And a lot of my favorite songwriters have really, really influenced my writing, I think.
So Stephen is among them. And you mentioned Belle and Sebastian. Is there anyone else? And Ray Davies, you mentioned a few, actually. Is there?
Yeah.
Those are the key guys?
For me, probably, yeah. Yeah, I would say, the Kinks, Magnetic Fields, and Belle and Sebastian are probably the most significant, I would say, for me.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of others. But yeah, in terms of lyrics, like actually literally affecting the way I write, I would say that those are my biggest inspirations.
Every once in a while, you'll mention a musical entity, like in your work, like Arcade Fire or something, and
yeah,
and you seem to have a sense of what it's like to be at a rock club. Like you're an outgoing music fan. When I mention Arcade Fire, I couldn't even tell if you, and I'm not asking you to call upon it. I sometimes wonder if you're even a little bit making fun of indie rock and making fun a little bit of music and the state of music these days.
I love music, you know, and I grew up around music. I grew up in New York City. I was in high school when like the Strokes broke, and for a brief period of time, you know, New York City felt like the center of the music world, mm-hmm. or at least it did to me. Mm-hmm. I was not in a rock band in high school, but 100% of my friends were. I grew up going to concerts, and it's a world that I haven't really experienced, but I definitely like have vicariously experienced it. And so I think, yeah, a lot of my stories are set in the music world for that reason. It's just a world that's always fascinated me, and the highs and lows of it are so extreme. Like I have a story in Hits and Misses called Relapse, which is about a sort of aging singer songwriter, and she was a one hit wonder, you know,
right.
one song that made it onto MTV, and since then it's been downhill. And it's about her kind of figuring out how to continue, you know, and deciding whether or not to keep pursuing art, you know, now that the glory has passed her by. And it's, you know, it's a fascinating subject to me.
Yeah, that's another story where you're kind of mocking the celebrity infrastructure, so to speak.
Yeah, hopefully with a little bit of empathy. You know, I've written about a lot of struggling musicians, you know, has-beens or musicians who are trying to make it and haven't quite gotten there and maybe never will. And I think that because the music industry is so hard, you know, and has been for so many years now, I think it just makes for a very visceral setting, you know. There's something very rootable and tragic about you know, an aspiring musician, you know, post Napster.
Well, did you, in your pursuit of comedy, did you pursue stand-up at all, or were you always writing?
No, I never really did. I mean, a couple of talent shows maybe in high school.
Yeah.
But I was never good at it.
Now, why do you suppose that is? You seem like you have a performative quality to you. I've heard you on other podcasts where you're before an audience. You have them in the palm of your hand, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, you know, reading is easier for me because it's so controlled. And it's, you know, when I'm just reading stories I've written verbatim,
yeah,
then I feel like a little bit more confident and comfortable. But stand-up, well, the biggest thing is stand-up is autobiographical, you know, kind of by nature. There are character stand-ups, you know, who go on and play somebody completely different. But in general, the kind of idiom demands a kind of autobiographical openness, or at least an illusion of openness.
Yeah.
You know, typical stand-up comedian goes up and says the word I a lot. I think this, I feel this, I did this. And I've never, it could be all made up. But at least it's you kind of, there's this expectation when you're watching a stand-up comedian that he or she is telling you about their inner life. And I've always preferred to tell stories metaphorically, you know, I want to be authentic and I want to talk about, you know, my real private emotions, because otherwise what's the point? But I've always preferred to kind of tell those stories indirectly and through the adventures of characters that are not literally me.
Well, it's fascinating you bring this up, because I've talked to a couple of stand-up comedians lately just about this distinction between sort of distanced observational comedy or one-liner comedy versus mm-hmm. more confessional stuff.
Sure, right, of course. Yeah, if you're Stephen Wright, then you're not, you know, you're not speaking from the heart, you know, about, you know, something that you experienced in childhood. You're making great jokes, and that's another way to go. And when I did try stand up in high school, that is what I did. When I look back at when I was like 16, 17, 18 years old, at talent shows, the few times I went up there as an amateur stand up comedian, I was definitely trying to do the Mitch Hedberg, Stephen Wright thing.
Yeah. Okay.
So even then I knew I was never going to, you know, I was never going to want to be that confessional guy. I've also never written a memoir. I've never written nonfiction of any kind. I've never even written a book review. You know, I really, really don't like to write literally about myself. And part of it is because I feel like people would not be interested. Because, like I said, my life is pretty boring. You know, I haven't experienced any real adversity. Everybody goes through the same, you know, things growing up. Everyone, you know, everyone has a bully. Everyone has heartbreak. Everyone, you know, has something in their past that they didn't enjoy. But yeah, you know, it's like I look at a guy like David Sedaris. I could read 100 books about his childhood.
Right.
I don't think I'd want to read half a book about my own.
Well, that's an interesting aspect of doing public work or being a celebrity as well. Are you surprised when people like me want to interview you because of your work? Because that's what it is. It's an insatiable need on my part. I'll speak for myself. Like, I really love your work. I love your writing. I want to speak to you because I want to know what went into it. I want to know where it's coming from. I figure if I talk to you, I might get some insight on that. And I feel like, I know I've talked to musicians and writers and artists who feel like, I think the thing I made should be enough, you know?
Right.
You've gotten to know me a little bit from the thing I made. Why do you need to talk to me as well?
Right. No, I for starters, I really appreciate those kind words. It really means a lot to me. And I'm the same way. I love, you know, I love reading about artists' processes. I think it's fun, you know. I was watching an interview with Ray Davies on YouTube just last night, you know.
Like, yeah.
I love that stuff. I'm always happy to talk about it, and I hope you know, I hope I can articulate exactly what I do as a fiction writer, because it's hard to explain sometimes, you know, because I don't always set out with such a specific strategy, and it only kind of in retrospect am I able to say, like, oh yeah, I guess I was kind of doing this with that book.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've talked a little bit about your work here, and the one thing I wanted to ask you is this realm that you seem to operate in quite a bit, which is short story writing, pieces for The New Yorker. You've done sketch writing, I presume, for SNL. I don't know exactly what you did there, but these kind of compact, short sort of bursts of thought and creativity. Like, what do you know why you're sort of drawn to these kinds of, this kind of storytelling, kind of that compact thing?
I think I do know, although I only very recently have I kind of started to think, like, why am I mostly writing stories? Because I have written a couple of novels, but I they're not my favorite books of mine. I feel like my most successful books, in my opinion, creatively, are my story collections, Hits and Misses and Spoiled Brats and Man Seeking Woman. Those are my favorites of the ones I wrote. And I think the reason why I prefer short stories is because you can just, on a basic level, you can take bigger swings.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can, I have a story in my new book, Hits and Misses, that's, you know, from the point of view of Paul Revere's horse,
right?
You know, I have a story about a father to be who is an aspiring, struggling novelist, and he finds out that his unborn fetus in utero is writing the great American novel,
right?
You know, from inside the womb. You know, these are really big swings, and you can't really sustain them for hundreds of pages,
right?
Because it would start to strain credulity and also kind of overstay its welcome. So, you know, it just, sometimes when I'm writing a novel or even a screenplay, like a feature length screenplay, I feel like my arms are kind of tied behind my back a little, because I can't, like, take as crazy risks as I can, you know, in a 5-page story or a 10-page story. It also, I think, just comes from being a fan of the form. You know, like, growing up being obsessed with writers like Shirley Jackson and I mentioned King already, but, you know, T.C. Boyle or, you know, Richard Matheson or Philip Dick. There's something about the short story form where, yeah, you can kind of do whatever you want and not have to worry about whether it's all going to blow up, you know, 100 pages from now. It's freeing.
Does it speak to your own attention span and interest in variety?
Definitely my interest in variety. I mean, like, I love that in a single book I can write, you know, a Sherlock Holmes parody, a sci-fi story, and like a Western. Like, that's really exciting to me as a writer.
Yeah.
In terms of attention span, I mean, I do love novels. I do love reading novels. I even love reading realistic novels. You know, I love Richard Yates. I love Cheever. I have a lot of respect for that kind of writing as well. You know, like, fully realized naturalistic writing. It's just never been what I've loved making myself.
I understand. All right. Well,
yeah.
Well, we're running out of time, but I want to give you an opportunity to maybe cite, because I mentioned a slew of credits. I don't know, and I started off bumbling about how I didn't even know if your show was still on the air. So do you mind?
No, it's all good. It's all good.
I'm in
Most
Canada.
People, yeah.
We don't get.
I'm thrilled that you knew it was ever on the air to begin with. Not a lot of people saw that show.
So I just wanted to ask you to sort of, you know, briefly list what you're currently up to, current credits, and also, you know, things we might want to look forward to, and within that also where people can learn more about you, because in your slightly self-loathing stature as someone who doesn't think they're all that interesting as a person. I feel like you keep kind of a low profile on the internet, but maybe I'm wrong. So
right. Well, yeah, I'm not on social media. Right, for that same reason of like, I just can't imagine that anybody would care about my literal opinions about anything. and certainly nobody would care about what I'm doing in my day-to-day life. Obviously I'd be thrilled if people would check out the books. I work very hard on them. I'm very proud of them.
Do you feel loved, Simon? Do you feel like you have a fan base?
Yeah, I do. I'm super grateful for it. I mean, you know, my childhood dream is to try to emulate my heroes and write the kinds of stories that other people would actually want to read, you know? The goal was always, you know, if I can write a book that people start and then want to read until the end, that would be, you know, the great victory of my life. And so whenever someone says I've pulled it off, I'm really grateful. But I hope people will check out Hits and Misses. That's my new one. Spoiled Brats was another one that I like that one a lot. And Man-Seeking Woman. I think those are I've written seven of these things now, but I think those are the three best.
Okay. And what are you currently working on? Who are you working for? What are you working on?
Well, I've got a TV show coming out soon based on one of my novels, actually, called Miracle Workers.
Okay. Okay.
That stars Steve Buscemi as God.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's a lot of fun. And that comes out sometime in 2019. And I'm working on, you know, what else? I'm working on another collection of stories. About halfway done with it, but it doesn't have a title yet. But it's a lot of fun.
Is it still kind of LA oriented, like celebrity
this
oriented?
This one, no. This one weirdly is like, how would I describe it? It's kind of stories about friendship, I would say, and kind of like how friends can drift apart or in some cases drift back together in unexpected ways, and sort of about the effects of time on relationships, I would say.
Okay.
That's very vague. It's very vague, but that's I mean, you know, it's also about rocket ships and rats and, you know, and flying bats and the whole thing. So
even though we were discussing your interest in variety and the fact that you can go in all these places with these short stories, it sounds to me like you still like to have a kind of thematic umbrella for them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they all come from a very, you know, simple emotional place. And then as I'm writing about basically my, you know, my feelings, my deepest, strongest feelings, I just, as I put the, you know, as I put the stories down, they end up kind of jutting out in all of these unexpected directions. But yeah, they all start from a place of like, what am I feeling right now? What's on my mind today? And then, you know, instead of writing, well, this is what happened between me and this other person, I end up, you know, with a story about, you know, a talking horse or whatever.
Well, for what it's worth, from my modest perch here in Canada, I will tell you that these stories you're writing, it's among the, you know, it's among the funniest and most brilliant stuff I've ever read. And
so nice of you. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, I hope you keep doing it. It sounds like you will be. And is it fair to say that people can learn more about Hits and Misses at littlebrown.com or perhaps
sure.
perhaps even simonrichbooks.com?
Yes, there is a website that Little Brown made for me. God bless them. or on Amazon or any places where books are sold.
Libraries, bookstores, just go find Hits and Misses and all of Simon's work. Simon, this was a tremendous pleasure. I thank you for your time, and I know
thank you. Thanks so much. I really appreciate all the kind words. Seriously, thank you.
Special thanks to Claudia Gonson of Magnetic Fields and for Simon Rich. Simon Rich was just on the 434th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all iOS and Android platforms and also on Spotify, YouTube, and Audioboom as well. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for on any of those platforms, for some reason you heard about something and you can't find it there, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, should probably send one of those out soon, please visit vishkana.com. That's myname.com, and Vishkana is spelled exactly how you would think it would be spelled, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, follow us on Twitter @VishCreative, or follow me directly at vshtana. Listen to a radio show version of Creative Control on Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time around the world at cfru.ca or on an actual radio at 93.3 FM if you're in or near Guelph. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. I really do appreciate all the donors and the pledges, and if you have never done it before and want to support the show, please do. It means a lot. Patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again for the in-kind support that I receive from the likes of Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, and Granddad's Donuts. Thanks, too, to my friend Jim Guthrie. He lets me use one of his songs to end the show. It's called The Rest Is Yet to Come. He took out his voice for it, so you know he cares. He gave me the instrumental version of The Rest Is Yet to Come. You can learn about the real version of that song, if you will, the one with the words, and also you can learn more about all of his stuff at jimguthrie.org, and I urge you to do so. Guy's a genius. jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode of the show and other episodes of the show, and for subscribing to the podcast. It really does mean a lot that you follow the show however you do, and I hope you will continue to do so. I have many more episodes left in me, I hope. There's more to come. And that's all I have to say. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.